that could end up with human beings entering the cosmic scene. So that just did get published, and I do believe it will hit the internet, but you're getting the first news right here. And it demonstrates the principle that we've been documenting at Reasons to Believe, that the more we learn about nature, the more evidence we have for the supernatural handiwork of God. And the two evidences here is the timing is perfect, and also the quantity of the silica-based sand compared to olivine-based sand, that quantity ratio likewise must be fine-tuned in order to have 3.8 billion years of life history on planet Earth. So we got people at the microphone, so I'm going to stop talking. And as long as there's people there, you won't hear from me. So I'm talking about new discoveries, but go ahead.
We also you have a text question already, so I'm going to let John go, and then we'll do a question coming in over the phone.
And before we go to John, this is actually the oxygenation history of the Earth. And so oxygen was kept very low because of this olivine sand, and it bumped up. And just at the right time, it came up to make animals possible and finally human beings. But go ahead, John.
The subject matter is the migration of early man. Now, we know that the Garden of Eden is the starting point in the Bible for modern man. And that undoubtedly is the location of that is under the Persian Gulf. As we've talked about before. However, in accordance with paleontology, the most early settlements of modern man are in Africa. And I believe I read a recent discovery where the migration out of Africa was earlier than they thought. It was about 60,000 years ago. I think it was in Saudi Arabia they found some evidence of that. You can correct me if I'm wrong on that. And so the question is, please discuss RTB's model about the relationship of the Garden of Eden to Africa and the earliest indications of modern man that we currently have in Africa and the migration with this new evidence and so on. So I'd like to have an overall picture of how you view that. Thank you.
Sure. And if you want a detailed answer, you'll find it in my book, Navigating Genesis, but I'll try to give a brief answer to your question. And you are right that what you see in Genesis 2 is the Garden of Eden being located in what is now the southeastern portion of the Persian Gulf. You get that because the text talks about four known rivers coming together. And the only location where they come together today is about 250 feet below sea level. But during the last ice age, it was about 100 feet above sea level. And so that's why I believe that the Garden of Eden event happened sometime during the last ice age. And so that would put a date on God creating Adam and Eve at somewhere between, say, 20,000 and 130,000 years ago. Now you're referring to dates about finding evidence for early human activity in Eastern Africa as well as Arabia. Those dates are not radiometric dates. And so what I pointed out in both our book, Who is Adam and Navigating Genesis, the best scientific date when you take into account both the random and systematic errors is 150,000 years ago, plus or minus 150,000 years. So the problem with trying to date human origins scientifically, we lack an objective dating method that has high precision. Now, if we're talking something in the neighborhood of, say, 40,000 years ago or less, you can use carbon-14 dating. If you're talking something more than a million years, you've got radiometric dates. But there's this gray zone where we don't have a good scientific dating method.
Where are the error bars?
Well, the error bars, I mean, typically when you read the scientific literature, they only give you the random error bars. They don't give you the systematic error bars, mainly because in many cases, they're not even sure what the systematics are. And what I mean by systematics are assumptions that could push the date
to one side or to the other. Random errors talk about how accurate the measurement is, but the systematics tell you that there may be assumption-laden that could actually push the measurement one way or the other. And the systematic errors are always much bigger than the random errors when we talk about dating human remains. So that's just a caveat on all the dates that are out there. But what you will see in the scientific literature in terms of dating the earliest undisputed evidence for human activity, it clusters in East Africa, Arabia, and the Persian Gulf. And so what I mentioned in Navigating Genesis, there are three periods during the last ice age where you got an easy, rapid migration route from the Persian Gulf into Africa. And keep in mind, during the last ice age, there was a land bridge joining Arabia to Eastern Africa, so people wouldn't have to cross any water. And there were three periods when there was a lush valley going through what is now called the empty quarter. In fact, let me pull this back up here for you. This is actually taken in the empty quarter. The empty quarter refers to the bottom third of Arabia, and the whole bottom third looks like that today. But there were three times during the last ice age where the Gihon River flowed through the southern part of Arabia, and that would have allowed an easy migration route from Africa into the Persian Gulf and from the Persian Gulf into Africa. I'm trying to remember the dates, so I'm guessing at this point, but I think the earliest date is like 115,000 to 117,000 years ago when that easy migration route was in place. Another one is like 77,000 to 78,000 years ago, and another one is around 45,000 years ago. So you can take your pick. That's kind of the status for the best evidence we have for the location and the dates for human origins. And as far as what we can look for in the future, I don't have a lot of hope that we're going to get better data. We just lack the tools that we need to get that better data. Although what I think will happen is that we will eventually find evidence for early metallurgy. I mean, the assumption was that you didn't have metallurgy or sophisticated agriculture until 12,000 years ago. But they've now found evidence at 23,000 years and 36,000 years ago that humans were actually engaged in farming, harvesting grains, roasting the grains, grinding the grains, and making bakery products, all on a very small scale because of how highly variable the global mean temperature was. But likewise, I think we will eventually find evidence for metallurgy that dates that early, but likewise, it's going to be on a very small scale, which explains why it hasn't been discovered yet.
At least part of the population was localized to the Garden of Eden at that time. The mic wasn't on. repeat the question.
Yeah, you need to be a little closer to that microphone.
Okay. At the time of Cain and Abel, and where Cain went off to another city, it would be a reasonable assumption that at least part of the population at that time was still local to the Persian Gulf area, and maybe a portion of it siphoned off and migrated. That's a possibility. What would be the motive for migrating to Arabia and then East Africa? What would be their motive for going down there? Was it a really lush paradise down there at that time?
Well, you made reference to Genesis 4 and how Cain left the Garden of Eden locale and went to the land of Nod. And please, none of you, don't go to the land of Nod while we're doing this. And the land of Nod was some distance. You see that implication in the text. But likewise, it was probably a place where you had relatively lush vegetation. And likewise, I would think whenever you got migration routes that have lush vegetation, you're going to see humans migrating. And so today, if you're in the Persian Gulf area, there really isn't much outside that area, but there were, during the last ice age, there were times when indeed that happened. And yeah, as early as Genesis 4, you've got some significant migration going on. But keep in mind, we got big error bars in terms of what the Bible says. The Bible only gives us a rough indication, doesn't exactly give us the location, just says that the land of Nod is to the east of Eden. Doesn't tell us how far. Probably somewhere in Persia. And likewise, in terms of the science, we don't have really specific data at this point.
Hugh, we got a question in coming in over the text. This is the first time we've ever had a text in question at the Skeptics Forum, so is a big deal. And it fits right in with that question. Do you believe that an actual Adam and Eve existed? And if so, what scientific evidence do we have for their existence? How did all people groups arise from two people?
Okay. Well, I do believe that there is an Adam and Eve, that there are two real people from whom all humanity is descended. You actually see a reference to that in the book of Acts, where it talks about how all nations come from one man or one blood. And in terms of scientific evidence for that, there's not scientific evidence that proves it, but for example, mitochondrial Y chromosome DNA analysis is consistent with all of humanity coming from one man and one woman. But a caveat is it's also consistent with all of humanity coming from a few women and a few men, but it is consistent with the one man, one woman idea. And as far as looking at the genetic evidence today, it indeed is consistent with all humanity coming from two individuals. I mean, of all life forms on planet Earth, what's remarkable about the human species, even though there's 7.5 billion of us, our DNA is remarkably uniform amongst the individuals that make up the human population. So, for example, even though Neanderthals were considerably less numerous, we see significantly greater DNA variation. And that, you know, they were around longer with much smaller population, and yet they have a greater genetic diversity. So, and I think what's interesting too is the greatest genetic diversity you see in the human population is between the Zulu blacks and the Bantu blacks that live in South Africa. So even though you got people living close together, you can get significant diversity. In fact, Africa is a place where you see the greatest diversity. And that's one reason why people think the first humans must have been in Africa, because that's where you see the greatest genetic diversity. But Africa is also the place where people practiced marriage isolation. So, for example, the reason why the Bantu and Zulu blacks have such great genetic diversity compared to one another, Bantus would never let one of their sons or daughters marry a Zulu, and likewise the Zulus, and that went on literally for thousands of years. And so basically preserved a genetic diversity that you don't see in Africa, or pardon me, in Asia or Europe.
Go ahead, Al.
Good morning. I have a question that concerns the chaos in the cosmos. Evidently, they found
astronomers, I hope.
Well, that we were just missed by a comet or an asteroid by 115,000 miles.
Yes.
And they didn't know until 2 days later or something like that. And we know what these comets and things can cause because of that one that struck in Siberia in 1907, I think it was, but the year I was born. And it devastated a huge area of Siberia. So my question is, God does not keep very good track of all these things that are going on in the cosmos, because, I mean, it's just one big explosion after another eventually. everything that's out there will eventually explode. And, well, that's my question anyhow.
Well, it's a good question
now. He's omnipotent. He's not a very good tracker.
Yeah, you'll actually see a chapter in the book Improbable Planet on the solar system's asteroid and comet belts. And it's fairly new evidence that we have because for the first time we can actually detect... You can't hear? Okay. It's okay? All right. For the first time, we astronomers are actually to detect asteroid and comet belts around other planetary systems. And we notice is the vast majority have no comets or asteroids at all, about 90%. About 10% have asteroid and comet belts 1,000 times bigger than the ones we see orbiting the sun. And we actually now understand why this happens. Because most of the planetary systems we see, it's where the gas giants have migrated in towards their host stars to inside the orbit of the Earth. And when that happens, those gas giant planets scatter out all the comets and asteroids. And most of the planetary systems we observe have that characteristic. They got gas giant planets orbiting close to their host stars. And so they have no asteroids or comets. The other 10%, the gas giants don't migrate at all. So they basically remain where they formed. And they have enormous asteroid and comet belts, literally thousands of times bigger than we see. What's unique about our solar system is that Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune migrated towards the sun. Jupiter got the closest, but it stopped at about the orbit of Mars. And then it reversed and migrated back out. And so that moving in towards and stopping at about the orbit of Mars and moving back out caused 99% of the comet and asteroid belts to be scattered. But five small asteroid and comet belts remained. And this is the only planetary system we see that's got small asteroid and comet belts. And we now recognize that's crucial for human civilization. Because if you have no asteroids and comets at all, then you've got no source to replenish the very slow leakage of water from the Earth. Now water, you know, Earth's gravity is pretty good at hanging on to its water, but not totally. And if it had enough gravity to hang on to its water without losing any, we'd also be hanging on to a lot of other gases that would be bad for human civilization. And so the Earth's gravity is fine-tuned, but there is a small loss of water. But the water we lose is replaced by the comets that impact the Earth. Comets are 85% frozen water. So the water we lose gets perfectly replaced by the water we gain. But you're right, sometimes we get hit by something quite big. And so if you go back 66 million years ago, there was a 6-mile diameter asteroid that smashed into the Earth and wiped out all the big animals, including all the dinosaurs. But we humans actually gained some benefits from these big collision events. So for example, over half of the nickel that's in circulation in human civilization comes from an asteroid collision site, Sudbury, Ontario. That's where an asteroid hit, and it was a very rich, nickel-rich asteroid. And that's been a real benefit for our civilization. 80% of the gold that's in circulation, human civilization, and 80% of the platinum comes from an asteroid collision site in South Africa. So we actually have some benefits from getting occasional hits from these asteroids. However, you don't want that happening every day. I mean, we had big asteroid and comet belts, then we'd be impacted so frequently, you couldn't build cities. But events of that nature happen only about every 30 to 35 million years. And so it's actually possible to have a narrow time window in which we got human civilization. I'll give you another statistic. Have you ever seen that meteor collision site in Arizona, the Winslow crater site? An event like that happens about once every 10,000 years. and the energy release is roughly equivalent to the Hiroshima atomic bomb. So, but again, that's only once every 10,000 years.
Why an all-powerful God cannot control these chaotic events that happen that could wipe us out in any moment? And that was part of my...
Yeah, well, an all-powerful God could control these collision events so that Manhattan doesn't get hit and some sandy place in Arizona gets hit instead, where it only knocks out a few rats and mice and rattlesnakes. I mean, that God could do that. But something I've written about in my book, Why the Universe is the Way It Is, God could intervene. And you see instances recorded in Scripture where he has intervened to save humans from natural disasters. But if he were to do that all the time, it would blunt the benefit that we gain from just letting the laws of thermodynamics run. Letting the laws of thermodynamics run provides a powerful restraint on the expression of human evil. And so there's a reason why God only intervenes rarely rather than all the time. Because if he did it all the time, then we humans would lack the benefit of restraint from the laws of physics that keeps us from doing too many evil deeds. As it is, God tolerates quite a bit of evil, but he's got a plan to use the laws of physics and the randomness and the chaos that comes out of those laws of physics to eventually completely eliminate all evil and suffering. So he's actually using all this for good. But if you want the details, there's a whole book on it, Why the Universe is the Way It Is.
I've been alive a long time. Probably the oldest guy in here. I've never seen him intervene.
Pardon me, I didn't hear that.
I said I've been alive a long time, probably older than anybody here, and I've never seen him intervene.
Oh, he has intervened. Here's how God intervenes with the laws of physics. The more evil you commit, the more work you have to do to undo the damage of your evil, and the more pain you experience, and the more time you waste. And that's because God saw fit to put you in a universe where there's gravity, thermodynamics, and electromagnetism. Those laws of physics guarantee that the more evil we commit, the more work we're going to have to do, the more pain we're going to experience, and the more time we're going to waste. And if you're like the rest of us, you don't like those things. And so that's actually a motivation that God imposes on each of us. I said to my sons when they were growing up, if I don't discipline you, the laws of physics will.
All right, we got another question coming in from the phone, but I want to try to take a shot at that, Al. I have a challenge for you, Al. Find 10 Christians at random, okay, people you know in the class, and ask them, how has God intervened in their life in obvious ways? And I bet you all 10 of them will give you very clear ways in which he has intervened beyond the laws of physics in their life. So that's my challenge to you.
Well, let me add another one. Ask people, have you ever experienced an incident where you wanted to do evil, but you weren't able to pull it off because of the physical situation?
Very good, yeah.
Okay.
Here's the question. I heard somewhere that God won't heal amputees. Do you have an answer for the reason for that?
Yes, I do. I get asked that question quite a bit. And you actually see an incident in the Gospels where Jesus did heal an amputee. Someone had a withered hand that was useless and healed it so that it could be fully operable. But again, God does that rarely. And he wants us to experience the benefits of the laws of physics. So for example, notice, God allows all of us to get older. As we get older, we decay. And if you don't believe that, look around at one another, okay? We're all in the process of progressing decay, at least those of us who are older. So, but... Okay. So, while God could intervene, he chooses not to because he really wants us to benefit from the laws of physics. And there will come a time when those laws of physics won't exist. If you read the last two chapters of the Bible, It describes a realm where there's no gravity, where there's no thermodynamics, where there's no electromagnetism, where there's different space-time dimensions. Why? Because it's a realm where no one will ever use their free will to express evil or evil intent. And therefore, those laws are no longer needed, and those space-time dimensions are no longer needed. And if that's a point where there won't be amputations, there won't be disease, you won't get gray hair. I'm sorry about that.
That's okay. At least I've got it.
Or, yeah, I mean, I don't have any, so. So there will come a time. And you know what it tells us in 2 Corinthians 4, that we're all experiencing physical decay, but those of us who've given our lives to Jesus Christ, we're experiencing spiritual renewal, and the spiritual renewal far outweighs the physical decay, because the physical decay is relatively slow, but the spiritual renewal can actually happen on a daily basis. And that's what's fun about being around people who have been followers of Jesus Christ literally for decades. You can see just how much beautiful they're getting in a spiritual context, and it far outweighs any physical decay they experience. And so I encourage people, go into rest homes where you've got believers that are experiencing significant physical decay, and just see how wonderful it is to be around them.
Thank you, Hugh. Doug?
Well, I'm tempted to, I could speak for an hour about what God's done for me, and if I got my prayer journal, I could speak for 4 hours. So maybe I'll talk to Al about that later. But I have a question about reasons to believe. When you guys go to work, do you have like little conferences? Do you talk to Fuzz Rana about biology? You talk to A.J. Roberts about viruses and all that? That's my first question.
Okay, I'll answer your first question.
That's it, Doug. That's your first question. That's the one question.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Get
back in line.
Yeah, at Reasons to Believe, we have about 2 scholar lunches a week where we debate one another and what we're doing in terms of our research and writing. And those are always fun sessions. And sometimes we go to a restaurant and have those dialogues and a whole lot of people listen in. Because
it almost seems like you're a biologist when I talk to you about biology and your expertise.
Well, I pick up a lot just listening to my colleagues. But you know what I really enjoy about those luncheons? Is the fact that we challenge one another, and it's like iron sharpening iron. And so I developed some of my best stuff by being challenged by my colleagues
on
my
research. And you still read books probably, right?
Pardon me?
You probably read a lot of books about biology and other fields of science?
Well, just go to my Facebook, especially go to my Twitter page. You'll see all the citations I'm giving to the scientific literature in many different disciplines. Incidentally, that's what we do at Reasons to Believe. We take top scholars out of academia and set them free to do interdisciplinary research. Because when I was at Caltech, I could only read the literature that was relevant to my research, because the research was just so intense. I didn't have time to read outside my subdiscipline. In fact, things were so bad back in those days that the whole astronomy department would go to a restaurant and take over the restaurant. But the ultraviolet astronomers would sit at one table, the X-ray astronomers at another table, radio astronomers at another table, and if you sat at the wrong table, you couldn't follow the conversation. That's how specialized science has become in the 21st century.
Okay, thanks.
Here we have a written question. How were people saved before Christ went to the cross?
How were people saved before Christ went to the cross? The same way we are. It tells us in Romans 1, for example, that all have heard, and that nature reveals God, his attributes. And, if you look at the book of Job, Job was one of the wisest and humblest of all men. But if you read that book of Job, he was actually able to declare all the basics of the gospel through the Redeemer. He didn't know the name of the Redeemer, but he actually knew that God had to be the Redeemer, that God was his advocate, and there was no other way he could be delivered from his propensity to commit sin and evil other than to go to his Redeemer and say, I know you're loving enough from what I see in nature, I know you're powerful enough from what I see in nature, and I know that you're knowledgeable enough from what I see in nature that you will do what I'm not able to do for myself. You will deliver me from my propensity. And so he's able to say in the 19th chapter, I know that my Redeemer lives, and I will see him in my flesh on the last day. So he not only knew the gospel plan, he was able to declare the assurance of his salvation, all through looking at what God had revealed in nature. Now, very few of us have the humility and the wisdom of Job. So today, God's got multiple ways of reaching us through books, testimonies, the Bible, etc. But yeah, in the Old Testament, everyone was exposed, just like everyone is exposed today. So that's why it says, no one was without excuse. We've all seen and heard.
Thank you. Peter?
Yes, if I made a statement like the finest stopwatch I own can measure hundredths of a second, and that therefore time can't be split infinitely because we can't measure it so. I heard a similar claim made by Vic Stinger in your debate with him at Caltech, and he claimed that since we can't measure time finer than the Planck time, that time is discrete, as he put it, in segments of the Planck time. And I took his argument to be that we really can't get to t equals zero and a singularity because of measurement of time. And I didn't hear that specifically addressed in the debate, but it seemed to me to be quite an egotistical claim that time is determined by man's measurement of it. Would you comment on that?
Yeah, what Victor Stinger was saying in that debate at Caltech is that perhaps time is not continuous, perhaps it's quantized. And so quantum mechanics might play a role in the expression of time. And says we can't prove that, but we can't disprove it either. We lack the measuring capacity to do it. And what would it take to actually show whether or not time is quantized at that level? It would take a particle accelerator that would go from here to a galaxy 12 billion light years away. And chances are that's not going to be funded anytime soon. So this is why you have physicists saying, well, since we can't make these measurements, we're free to speculate that maybe something really exotic is going on in the physics. And in the latest edition of The Creator and the Cosmos, I have a chapter that addresses what I call non-empirical attempts to avoid a theistic worldview perspective. And I think this is what's interesting. In the 21st century, our observations, measurements, and experiments overwhelmingly established that there must be a God beyond space and time that created the universe and specifically designed it for the benefit of us human beings. And it's become so overwhelming that those who take a non-theistic perspective are being forced to appeal to these non-empirical arguments, which are either cyclical arguments, circular reasoning, or they appeal to realms that we're not able to measure or may never be able to measure. Now, what's interesting in that part of this book, as I say, we've actually been able to push the frontiers of knowledge where we actually can penetrate to some degree the quantum gravity era. That's that era where, quote, time might be quantized. And it's by looking at the images of distant quasars and blazars. Because if there is quantization of space-time at a high level, where you've got high quantum space-time fluctuations in the space-time fabric, that would be amplified in the images of distant quasars and blazars. And so what would happen is those images would blur a little bit. And so we're able to look at those images and see if we see the blurring that would sustain the speculation that we got really big quantum space-time fluctuations. And we don't see any blurriness in those images. Now, this is emerging material. It's only been around for the past year that we've been able to make these kinds of measurements. And it's only been done in quasars and blazars at ultraviolet wavelengths that are 3 billion light years away. We could make the test much more definitive by looking at quasars and blazars 10, 12 billion light years away at X-ray wavelengths. That hasn't been done yet, but that would allow an even deeper penetration of the quantum gravity era.
Likewise, come this December, an array of radio telescopes that stretches around the planet and actually gives us a telescope power of a telescope with a diameter of 6,000 miles. That instrument is being used right now to image the event horizon of the black hole, the supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy. And that image will actually give us some information on what's happening in the quantum gravity here. And if we're lucky enough to find a neutron star in a close orbit about an imaged event horizon of a black hole, that would give us a really powerful penetration of the quantum gravity era. But it demonstrates the principle. The more we learn about physics, the more we learn about the universe, the more evidence we see for the supernatural handiwork of God, because what I point out in this book is that the measurements we have already don't support the quantum eternity theorem that's being put out by atheist physicists, but is really consistent with the theorem put out by Aaron Wall, where he says if these quantum space-time fluctuations are small enough, then the space-time theorems hold all the way to t equals zero. And in a corollary to his theorem, he says they might even hold if the quantum space-time fluctuations are big. But the measurements are indicating it doesn't look like they're big. But, and this is being discussed in the scientific literature. We've got atheists saying, well, maybe we don't need big quantum space-time fluctuations. But again, they're appealing to something we don't know and can't measure. And so what I share with audiences, everything we can know and measure and do experiments on tells us there really is a beginning to the universe. In the same manner that everything I know about my wife tells me she's real. But in that realm where I can't make measurements, I could speculate as a physicist that maybe I'm being fooled all these decades by a very sophisticated hologram. I mean, but all the measurable evidence tells me she's real and that she's not a hologram.
Here's a text-in question, Hugh.
Okay.
Do you see any similarities in the United States to any behavior or actions of a specific people or story recorded in the Bible?
Yes. You'll see this in the book of Isaiah, where it talks about the rebirth of the nation of Israel, which, depending how you interpret it, happened in 1948 or 1967. But what it tells us in the book of Isaiah is that it would be silver and gold from people dwelling in the distant coastlands that would play a key role in establishing this new nation of Israel. And there's actually historical evidence for this. In 1948, when Israel was formed, they were being attacked by 10 Arab nations around them. They didn't have the military equipment to hold back the attack. And so David Ben-Gurion sent a woman, Golda Meir, with $10 in her purse to New York. And she came back with $50 million. And those $50 million turned the tide in the Arab-Israeli war. And David Ben-Gurion, many years later, said, if it wasn't for the actions of a woman, there would be no new nation of Israel. But it was people dwelling in the distant coastlands that provided the gold and silver that made possible the rebirth of Israel. You'll find another reference in the book of Ezekiel, which is actually a reference to what will happen to people dwelling in the distant coastlands who live in safety. It's a reference to the future, which basically says their security and safety would be disturbed. You'll read about it in Ezekiel chapter 40 if you want to check it out. So, and the distant coastlands is a reference to big islands and big continents that are far away from Israel. And I think that would include us, but you could also argue maybe it includes Australia, New Zealand, and South America as well. But the point is, the gold and silver did come from the United States and Canada. And we are people living in relative safety and security.
Go ahead, sir.
I don't have much of a question. It's more of a comment. I'm glad to be here. I came across another organization who tries to blend religion and science together. And they're telling me the earth is 7,000 years old because they followed the Abraham's genealogy. I had a seizure and I woke up 3 days later laughing hysterically because, really? The earth is only seven? I'm glad that you're saying 3 billion years, 4 billion. That's great. But what concerns me a little bit is that I have this feeling, maybe I'm wrong, that we start, that the Bible is 100% correct, and I'm taking Genesis literally, and then I'm making science prove it, where I think it should be different. It should be the science starting and perhaps moving towards the book of Genesis, which you probably know this, or the audience knows this. The Hebrew Bible has at least three ways. There's poetry, there's allegories, and there's some history there. But it's not all literally. When you mention Job, it feels that people believe that it literally happened. But for our tradition, it's a story. It has a tremendous theological implication, the story of Job, but Job was not a real person, flesh and blood. Okay? So my concern is when I see science or religious institutions trying to make this fit into that, it concerns me a little bit. Because, unfortunately, a lot of violence has been committed to my people in the name of religion, or how we interpret religion. So when the interpretation gets strange, I step back and I say, oh, God, help me. Because, you know what I'm talking about. We can go back to the Inquisition. We can go back. So, but I'm glad, at least, you know, I'm happy with your organization. I don't understand everything. I'm not a scientist. But anyway, thank you. It was just a comment.
Well, it's an interesting comment, and you know, I agree with your statement that it's a mistake to try to take the Bible and force science into it. But, you know, that's not my story. My story is that I was not raised in a Christian environment. In fact, I didn't get to meet Christians till I was, to get to know them till I was 27 years of age. And my quest began through astronomy, where I realized, okay, it looks like the Big Bang is a correct model for the origin and history of the universe. And if that's the case, there's a beginning. If there's a beginning, there's a beginner. So I began to search for that beginner, first through the great philosophers, and discovered they had the wrong concepts of space and time. Then I began to look at the world's holy books. And what I was looking for were provable historical and scientific errors. I felt that this is a book that's communicated to us by the God of the universe. Given what I see in the universe, it's a God that seems to really like consistency and harmony. Therefore, I said, the way to tell whether this is invented by humans or it's from the Creator is if it's invented by humans, there will be mistakes and errors and contradictions. So I looked for those. And if you're looking at the Quran or the Hindu Vedas, it's not difficult to find several provable historical and scientific errors. But when I picked up the Bible, over the course of 18 months, I was not able to find any provable scientific errors or contradictions. Now, to be fair, I did find lots of texts that I didn't understand. But unlike what I saw in the Hindu Vedas or the Quran, I couldn't find provable errors or contradictions. And I found many places where the Bible actually predicted future scientific discoveries. And I saw that in no other holy book. Only the Bible actually predicts accurately future scientific discoveries. And as an astronomer, I was especially impressed that it predicted all the fundamentals of Big Bang cosmology, like the universe has a space-time beginning, that it expands from that beginning under laws of physics that don't change, where one of those laws is a pervasive law of decay, and therefore the Bible is implying that the universe must get colder and colder in a highly predictable way. And we astronomers actually have measurements of the past temperature of the universe that confirm what the Bible declared thousands of years ago. Now, I would agree this can be overdone, and I've run into other Christians that basically read science into the text that I don't think is there. I mean, as the president of Reasons to Believe, I get manuscripts on my desk, unsolicited, from people who think that Genesis 1 and 2 explains the particle creation model. So they're putting neutrinos in there, protons, and I'm saying, I don't see any of that in the text. And so one extreme is you're basically looking at almost every passage of the Bible as having scientific implications. But for example, I spoke at a seminary where seminary professors basically took the book of Job and said it says zero about science or creation. And it's like, you know, if you take this book as being an actual real account, I mean, it's got more science and creation content than any other book of the Bible. But their concern was if we read any science content of the Bible, we take a risk that it might not fit what we see in the established record of nature. On the other hand, if you have a zero-risk theology, you also have a theology that's incapable of persuading anyone that this is the inspired Word of God. And so, you know, we were just talking about what the Bible says about the future nation of Israel. What if the Bible said nothing about future history? Then we couldn't use history as a tool to persuade people this is actually beyond human capability. Likewise, if you strip all the science content of the Bible, you've got that problem. But for example, you can get a Four Views book. It's called Four Views on Creation, Evolution, and Intelligent Design. And one of the authors takes the position that the Bible has no science content at all. But you know, there's another position where you have extreme overlap. Our position is there is overlap, but we're not talking the majority of the text. It's part of the text, and it's the obvious parts, like Genesis 1, where it talks about this account of creation. You know, clearly it's talking about real things that God did to prepare the planet for humanity. So I say, well, you can't deny the science content there. The question is, does it actually match what we scientists measure? And that was actually a big part of my coming to faith in the Bible, was recognizing Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 correctly described everything and put it in the correct chronological sequence. Whereas when I looked at the ancient Near Eastern creation stories, everything was out of order. And a lot of the stuff that was described wasn't even a correct description. So that was a major factor in turning my life from an atheistic worldview perspective to a theistic one and a Christian one. But yeah, good comment. And yeah, I'm frequently involved in debates with other believers where I think they've gone to one extreme or the other. And I think the best way to balance it out, we need to challenge one another. I mean, that's the benefit, for example, of having these luncheons that we have where we challenge one another and say, you know what, I think you went too far, or I don't think you went far enough.
We're going to... Whoa, wow. Is that making up for why it was quiet before? We're going to do one more question before our break. Remember, if you want to get a chance to win a book, fill out that card. And if you would pass it, pass them that way. And if I could ask Bud and James on each side to go down and collect them. And we'll do a drawing, so you've got as long as it takes Hugh to answer this question to fill those out and get them there. Hugh, the Bible seems to suggest that the universe came from nothing. Lawrence Krauss seems to suggest this also. It's hard to imagine something coming from nothing without at least the laws of physics existing and being true, even if there was no matter, space, or time. Would this be a proof of God?
Well, a long time ago, I gave a talk, Everything You Want to Know About Nothing. And I was making the point after Lawrence Krauss published his book, A Universe from Nothing, that if you read his book, you can actually find 9 different definitions of nothing in his book. And every one of his definitions is actually something. So it's common for physicists, for example, to talk about the universe being created out of a quantum space-time foam. Well, a quantum space-time foam is not nothing. We know from relativity and quantum mechanics that you can take quantum space-time foam and make particles out of it. Just like you can convert energy into matter and matter into energy, likewise you can convert space-time fluctuations into energy and matter. So what Lawrence Krauss is talking about is not really the universe coming out of nothing. Now what you see in the Bible in Hebrews 11:3, the universe that we can detect did not come from that which we can detect. So that's kind of a biblical definition of nothing. And we can detect matter, we can detect energy, we can detect space, we can detect time. So the Bible's claim is that the universe that we can see and measure came from something by God's hand that's completely distinct from matter, energy, space and time, the laws of physics, etc. So that's a big difference between what Lawrence Krauss is claiming than what the Bible has claimed for thousands of years. And the space-time theorems are consistent with what the Bible claims. They're not consistent with what Lawrence Krauss says, although I will give Lawrence Krauss some credit. On page 173 of his book, he concedes that we can't take deism off the scientific table. And that's because of the force of these space-time theorems. And that's actually, I'd say, a correct label. Most physicists and astronomers that I've met that label themselves as atheists, when you press them, you discover that they're actually deists. They'll say things like Stephen Hawking, "I think the universe came from the law of gravity." Well, he's basically making the point of deism, which is some agent brought the universe into existence, but that agent hasn't been doing a thing since he brought the universe into existence. It's basically the god of the 14-billion-year nap model. So, but theists believe that God not only acted at the beginning of the universe, he's acted since the universe, and he's acting in the lives of human beings today. So that's the difference between theism and deism. But deism is very popular amongst my peers.
Thank you, Hugh. Bud? James, bring those up. He's got them all. There's one more over there. Thank you, Diana. Thank you, James. We don't have a box or anything to put these in, Hugh, so we're just
going to... Just put them on the table.
You're just going to have to draw one. Oh, it's okay. It's okay. I know how to play cards. I can shuffle them. All right. Pick a card, any card. First name's Tim. Last name is S-E-C-H-A-N-G. Is that right? Come on up. Okay, so what we're... Yeah. What we're giving away is either a DVD, Journey Towards Creation, or Hugh's latest book, Creator in the Cosmos, or the second latest book, Improbable Planet. And since you drew first, you get your choice. Great. The latest and greatest. Congratulations. Okay, next one, Hugh. Margarita Cates. There you go. Right in front. No, you don't get to pray that you win. That's unfair. All right. Improbable plan. All right. Number three. Carl Yackey? Jackie? Yeah, very good. Yeah, congratulations, everybody. That's great. Okay, I think the next question is, it's the microphone's turn. So, Doug, you're at it again.
Let me give you this mic. I don't know if it's going to, because the mic is not sounding real good.
I also want to say one thing. I understand we have some students here from Cal State Fullerton. So welcome to you guys. Thank you for coming.
Don't you move over. Well, hold on a second.
Not over.
Yeah. Hello. Can you
Dan?
Can you hear me?
Yep.
My question is regarding the miracles that Christ performed in the Bible, tell us. And as a scientist, Dr. Russ, how would you explain what actually happened when Christ takes fish and the bread and multiplies it at 12,000, 7,000, and even have leftovers. Bible tells us there were 12 baskets left. So how would you, as a scientist, how would you explain what happened in your mind?
Yeah, good question. And you see in the Bible God performing three different kinds of miracles. Miracles that transcend the laws of physics, miracles that take place within the laws of physics, but demonstrate fine-tuned control, and then laws of simply sustaining the physics of the universe for the benefit of life on Earth. But what you see in the Gospels, especially the Gospel of John, is that it focuses on the miracles that God performed that the prophets of the Old Testament could not perform, basically making the point that Jesus is more than just a prophet, and that he's actually the one that is God that created the universe. For example, when we look at the universe, the cosmic creation event, it's clearly an act by a being who can move and operate outside of matter, energy, space, and time. And so what you see recorded, for example, in the Gospel of John, is repeated instances of Jesus performing miracles that are outside of what's possible within space, time, and the laws of physics and matter and energy, like walking on water, or as you say, transforming a few loaves and fishes into enough to feed 5,000 men and all their families as well. Sure. Well, I mean, for example, there were Old Testament scholars who were saying, well, a prophet can raise somebody from the dead, but a prophet can't raise anybody who's been dead for more than 3 days. And so with Lazarus, God waited till the fourth day before raising him, basically making the point that what you're seeing here is someone who's more than a prophet, is someone who actually has complete control over the physics of the universe. So this is what Jesus was trying to do, to establish that he was more than just a prophet. He was actually the one that created the universe. So that's what's distinct about the Christian faith. I mean, for example, in the Islamic faith, they believe that Jesus was a prophet.
You lost your picture.
Well, that's okay. They don't need to see the picture anymore. But what we see in the New Testament, and back, by the way, it also tells in the Old Testament that the Messiah would perform these kinds of miracles. So it's prophesied in the Old Testament that there would be one who would come who would perform these miracles, that one greater than Moses would come. Moses himself said that, someone greater than I will come.
I think where Dan was headed with that, though, Hugh, is how did he actually do it? Did he create matter out of nothing? Did each fish appear as it went to the next guy? Or, I mean, it's, I know it's speculative, but how would you think he might have done that?
Well, just like you can't explain how a human being can walk on top of the Sea of Galilee, or how that individual could also have Peter walk on the Sea of Galilee for a few seconds. That can't be explained within matter, energy, space, and time and the laws of physics. So it's demonstrating. In fact, that's what the disciples' reaction was. You know, who is this individual? When they saw him walking on water, when they saw him calm the storm, a storm that was threatening their lives, and with one word, Jesus transformed that life-threatening storm into perfect calm. And the reaction is, who is this individual? Well, Jesus was simply making the point, I'm one who's greater than the laws of physics. And so, yeah, my answer to that is, it was a miracle that God, he literally produced it, not from existing material. It was basically brand new stuff. So,
thank you.
Thank you. Hugh, what caused that beach in Hawaii to keep the green sand?
Okay, that sand will not stay green for much longer. Because it's existing in an oxygen-rich environment. And, you know, the reason why we see green sand there, it came up from the deep interior mantle of the Earth. If it came up from the top mantle part, it wouldn't be green like that, which is why most lava flow eruptions, you don't see olivine rich material. That's one single incident where we do. Yeah, if you wait long enough. In fact, if you actually go to that beach, you'll see parts of the beach where the green stuff is actually starting to turn and look like regular sand. But yeah, there's certain parts of it. In fact, that zoom in was actually looking at a part of the beach that's nothing but olivine crystals. I've been to that beach, so not all of it is olivine crystals, but you do find some parts that are.
Thank you. Do we have another person at the mic? You're on, Doug.
Well, to use some scientific terminology here, I'm tripping. I'm tripping here because, like, right before the break, the question from the internet was about Lawrence Krauss and nothing from something to nothing or nothing to something. And Al was just talking about miracles. He was right there when this happened. And then he sat right next to me. So anyway, that's a comment. But I'm going to go ahead with my question anyway. I don't really understand what Lawrence Krauss is saying, but I'd like to quote him here. The amazing thing is once you apply, in fact, quantum mechanics to gravity, as you were beginning to allude to in your last segment, that's what it says right here, that is possible. In fact, it is implied that space itself could be created where there was nothing before, that literally whole universes could pop out of nothing by the laws of quantum mechanics. And the question is, why is there something rather than nothing? It becomes right because nothing is unstable and it will always produce something. And so that's what he said on this NPR broadcast in 2012. And so getting to the point here, one would have to infer a timeless quantum flux of information without energy or a vacuum would need to occur to begin space-time. But still, this is an absolute nothing. In reality, an actual nothing is not only the absence of space-time and matter, but also the absence of quantum states.
Doug,
the laws of physics, I'm almost finished, and information. By definition, an actual nothing cannot produce something. The Big Bang is a miracle. William Legg Craig said, "This skeptical response represents, I believe, a deliberate abuse of science." The question is, do you agree?
Okay. Well, if you go back to Romans chapter 1, it talks about people who reject God and that their responses, they attribute to the creation properties that only the Creator possesses. And so this is an example of saying, well, okay, the laws of quantum mechanics created the universe. Well, the laws of quantum mechanics don't have any power of creativity. They're simply descriptive of the universe. And so, yeah, you got Lawrence Krauss saying quantum mechanics did it. You had Stephen Hawking saying gravity did it. But what they're doing is they're actually attributing creative powers to gravity and quantum mechanics.
It's an equivocation fallacy, I think, yeah.
All of our measurements tell us that's not the case. We see no creative capacity in the laws of physics. And, you know, we physicists have been measuring them for a long, long time. If indeed nothing is unstable, we would have seen some examples of that. We don't see any examples of that. And if nothing were truly unstable, we'd all be in real trouble because everything would be disturbed. So, you know, thank God that nothing is not unstable, because otherwise we'd have stuff popping into existence all over the place. But again, all of our observations are consistent with the fact that the laws of physics are descriptive. They don't possess powers within themselves. We have to look elsewhere to explain why the universe has a beginning. But so yeah, like don't be surprised if people, Jim, we see that in biology as well, where people will attribute, say, to genetics, creative power that the genetics simply doesn't have.
So a quantum vacuum is something, right?
Vacuum is something.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, whenever a physicist says something came from nothing, ask him, what kind of nothing are you talking about?
Hugh, here's a question from a text. It's a very good question. How does the act of sacrifice clear up sin?
How does the act of sacrifice clear up sin? Well, the Bible tells us that God is a holy God. He's not able to tolerate any evil or sin in his presence. And since we're all sinners and have all had the propensity to commit evil, the only way we can actually have fellowship with God is if someone pays the penalty for our offenses. And this is what the creator of the universe did for us on the cross. He took upon himself the penalty, the holy penalty for all the offenses we've committed against God and one another. And so what you have the creator of the universe doing is paying a payment that none of us are able to pay on our own account. So in your analogies that have been used is, what if I got a debt of $1 trillion? Given my salary, there's no way I can pay that debt off. But someone who actually has that kind of money can come forward and say, look, I'll take care of your debt for you. Well, likewise, the creator of the universe has come forward and has taken care of that debt for us. You know, a corollary I've gotten to that is, how can a man dying on the cross for 6 or 9 hours actually take upon himself the holy penalty of all the offenses committed by human beings? And I answer that question in the book, The Creator of the Beyond the Cosmos, by saying the one that died on the cross, in addition to being a human being, was the God that created the universe. It's a God that created the space-time dimensions of the universe, a God that's got the power, according to the space-time theorems, to create space-time dimensions at will. Who says that he only suffered for 6 to 9 hours? That's an hard time frame. But in the time dimensionalities that he's able to experience, he could have easily accommodated 100 billion infinitely long lines of time in which he suffered the penalty for all the offenses that we've committed against God and one another. And I think when we appreciate the depth of what happened in those 6 to 9 hours, then who, as it says in Hebrews 2:3, who can turn down such a magnificent offer of redemption? If we really appreciate the depth of what was done on our behalf, who in their rational mind would turn down that offer? And that's an offer that God makes to every human being who's ever lived. And that's something that Job recognized. He recognized, as you can see in the 17th chapter, he recognized he did not have the power to deliver himself from his propensity for sin and evil. But an all-powerful, all-loving God must have provided a way. So he says, I'm going to go to that God. So he was basically believing in what God would provide on his behalf. But we can look back in time and say, we don't have to look forward. It's already been done on our behalf.
Al?
I'm back. A few months back, the so-called pastor of America died. I'm talking about, what's his name?
Billy Graham. Billy Graham. No, Billy Graham. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, he was my favorite televangelist. He said one time in one of his sermons that he knew what heaven was like. And he said it was 120 miles long by 120 miles wide, and that we would sit by a huge fireplace and angels would wait on us. And we would go down those golden streets in a brand new Cadillac convertible. That was great. How could you not love him? Anyhow, I looked him up in, I don't know, Google or something. Had his little bio. When he died, he was worth $30 million. Well, you know, that's a little sum. That's not a great sum, but it's some. So I wondered, $30 million, hasn't he ever read the Bible? The Bible says, it is more difficult for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to go to heaven. Isn't that right? It's Matthew and, I don't know, Matthew and I had it written down. Matthew and Mark, I think. Matthew and Mark, yeah, I got it right. So he didn't read the Bible very much, did he? But what kind of a Christian was he?
Well, Al.
I mean, this is.
Yeah,
I guess
good comment, but there was a sermon given in this church a few months ago where the pastor explained that very text, how it's difficult for a rich person to enter heaven, as difficult as a camel to go through an eye of a needle. Now, it's not talking about a needle that you use to sew thread. It's actually a geological feature where you got a small hole in a mountain. So he's making the point as difficult but not impossible. But what I loved about the sermon, he went on to say, here's what the Bible defines as a rich person. A rich person is someone who's so wealthy, they know that they're going to eat the day after tomorrow. They got enough wealth where they can not only have enough food for today and tomorrow, but even the next day. And they're also wealthy enough that they actually have not one change of clothes, but two changes of clothes or more. And then he addressed all of us in the congregation. Okay, how many of you fit that description? Well, the truth is, we're all rich by that definition.
Well, you can always, like, for Al, Trump,
let him
for
finish.
Trump probably, you could probably expand that needle.
Yeah, but so it's basic. But Jesus is making the point is that, you know, most of us are in that category. In fact, even in the poor nations of the world today, most people are in that category. And we need to realize, don't let the wealth that you have give you a sense of security where you think, I've got wealth and I don't need God. And so that's what it means when it says it's difficult for a rich man to enter into heaven, because what happens when you got wealth is you begin to think, I don't need anybody else's help. I don't need God's help. However, it says it's difficult, not impossible. What we need to do is realize, okay, the wealth I have is a gift from God. It can disappear at any time. I can't put my security in my wealth. I need to put my security in God, and I need to be generous with the wealth I have. What you see throughout the whole of the Bible is that God blesses people with wealth so that they can use that wealth to serve other people. So having wealth does not make you unrighteous. However, it's what you do with the wealth that makes you unrighteous.
That's the reason I never got wealthy, because I read that a long time ago.
Well, I can tell you, Al, by the Bible's definition, you are a wealthy man. Challenge to you is the same as the challenge to me. By the Bible's definition, I'm wealthy. What am I doing with the wealth that I have?
I'm very poor, so I don't have to worry.
I don't think there's a poor person in this whole room. So we all have enough wealth that we know we're going to eat the day after tomorrow.
That's a very small hole in the needle.
But the whole point is, what are you doing with the wealth that God has given you? Are you using it to serve others? Or are you using it to serve God? Do you have the mindset, look, this is a gift from God, it can disappear any time, and if it does, that's okay. But good comment. Thanks.